This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The books and movies about Vietnam we're familiar with deal with the French and their colonization of the country in the 19th century, or U.S. involvement there beginning in the 1950s and ending after a long war and finally the fall of Saigon in 1975. This, however, is not the case with a new book titled The Sacred Willow, Four Generations in the Life of a Vietnamese Family. This memoir reveals how the members of a Vietnamese family saw themselves living their own history. The author of The Sacred Willow is Mai Elliott, and she is our guest this afternoon. Mai Elliott was born Duong Van Mai in Nam Dinh in the northern region of Vietnam. Following the partition of Vietnam in 1954, her family moved to Saigon. After high school, she obtained a scholarship to attend Georgetown. She graduated in 1963 and in 1964 married an American, David Elliott. During the 1960s, she and her husband worked in Saigon for the RAND Corporation on a research project studying the strengths and weaknesses of the Viet Cong. It was during this time that her feelings about the regime in Saigon began to change. Mai Elliott returned to the U.S. in 1968. Questions for our guest are welcome. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mai Elliott, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, well, thank you for talking with us this afternoon. First, to begin, would you talk with us about the significance of the title, The Sacred Willow?
It's a translation of my family name, but I also use it as a symbol for the resilience of my family and of the Vietnamese people, because the willow tree bends with the wind, but does not break.
Mm. And also, there is a legend involving the willow in your family.
Yes, that's right. There's a legend about the Zung willow. A long time ago, the son of a king fell sick, and a holy man from India broke a branch off a willow tree and dipped it in water, sprayed the water on the prince, and he revived. So the holy man brought him back from the dead, and from then on, the Zung willow was called a sacred tree.
Mm. You retired from a career in banking in 1993 to work on this book full-time. When was it that you determined this was a book that you wanted to write?
The book had been taking shape in my mind, you know, over the years. I thought of writing it when I was still a teenager living in Saigon. But of course, at that time, being young and immature, I just thought that it would make a good story to tell. And I didn't realize until much later that my family story also reflected the story of many Vietnamese and of Vietnam as a country. And that's how when I finally sat down to write the book, that was the shape of the book that emerged from my writing. Mm. So it's something that, you know, I thought of a long time ago, but it kind of evolved. And also, once I could talk to family members who had been on the other side of the war, of course, there was more information that I could add. So it grew mm-hmm. as I gathered material and as I interview relatives who are now scattered around the world, and especially those that are in Vietnam whom I hadn't seen for a long time because of the war. So, you know, it grew richer, in other words, as I went along.
Yeah. During the course of writing this book, you had to have examined and re-examined your life and recalled many memories. And also there were those reunions you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
There had to have been times when of great excitement, of great highs, and also of great sadness.
Well, precisely. Yes, that was exactly what happened, as you described. I had repressed many sad memories of the tragedies that happened to my family. So when I sat down and wrote the book, I had to just dredge those up from my memory. And it was very emotional at times. And the other side of it, as you mentioned, is the excitement of discovering so many other things about my family that I had not known before. Mm. The exhilarating things that they went through and the achievements that they had done. So those were the high points.
Yeah. You write that you discovered that your, quoting here now, your family network is as tangled as a century-old vine.
Yes.
What surprised you most, or what moved you most about working on this family memoir, knowing what you learned about your family and the history of your family?
When I started out, I knew that I didn't know everything there was to know. So researching the book was a discovery, like a long journey. And what moved me the most was, I think, the story of the people who had been on the other side of the war. My older sister, Tang, and her husband, and the tremendous hardships that they had to go through in order to fight and defeat the French during the period when the Vietnamese were resisting French colonial domination. And the other thing that I found that moved me to tears was discovering the suffering that my uncle Qing went through during the land reform that the communists launched in North Vietnam right after their victory against the French in 1954. I knew that he and his family suffered a lot, but I had no mm-hmm. idea of the extent of their suffering. So that was extremely moving. The thing that I found inspiring was the struggle that people like my sister and her husband went through to fight for a cause that they believed in strongly, which was to end colonial domination, which they viewed as something very detrimental to Vietnam and the Vietnamese.
Mm. This was your sister who married the communist?
Yes. Yes. He joined the Viet Minh movement led by Ho Chi Minh, but he never became a member of the Communist Party.
Mm.
Yes.
How divided was your family about politics when you were growing up? Or was it divided at that point, not at that point, but later?
I think the deepest division had occurred earlier. In 1945, 46, 47, those were the watershed years in Vietnamese history. That was when there were two horrendous events that took place, which split middle-class families like mine along ideological lines. So that was the deepest division, and that had occurred during that period, because there was the two events that I referred to. First of all, was a famine that killed an estimated 2 million people in North Vietnam. And Vietnamese blamed the French, who were still in charge of Vietnam at the time, and the Japanese, who were occupying Vietnam, for letting so many people die. And the second event was after Japan surrendered, there was a power vacuum in Vietnam. So Ho Chi Minh seized power and declared Vietnam independent, but the French refused to recognize that, and after the war sent reinforcements to try and take over Vietnam once more. And that was the second event that drove, you know, people like my sister and her husband into the ranks of the Viet Minh to fight the French, because they thought that was the only way to save their country. So, and that division was very deep and lasted until the end of the Vietnam War, because people like my husband, I mean like my sister and her husband who joined the Viet Minh, led by Ho Chi Minh, would then stay in the ranks of the, you know, of the Viet Minh, and later on would live and work in North Vietnam, opposing South Vietnam once the war erupted again. You know, the war that we now know as the Vietnam War erupted again. Mm-hmm. So that division lasted for some 30 years, from 1945, 46, 47, until the end of the war in 1975.
Mm-hmm. In the book's preface, you write about looking back at the work that you did for this book and seeing the irony and the unpredictability of history.
What I meant was that, people like my Uncle Ching, who had fought on the side, the winning side of the first civil war of Vietnamese, fighting against the French, who were also supported by other Vietnamese, that once the communists won, his side won, he became a loser because they started to persecute him. So, and the other side was that, you know, my family fled to Saigon and we were on the side of the South Vietnamese government backed by American power. And we thought that, you know, we had no idea that South Vietnam would fall as quickly as it did. So it just shows that, you know, things don't always proceed along the path that you predict, and mm-hmm. that they have a way of turning out very differently and very drastically.
Yeah. I'd like to spend some time talking about your great-grandfather.
Yes.
He was a scholar, a poet, and a mandarin, and he became governor of Thái Bình province. Why don't you tell us something about him and how he became governor?
At that time, Vietnam was still governed by a king and his court. And the court recruited administrators or officials to run the government through what we call a civil service exam. Yes, thank you. Civil service exam, which consisted of a series of progressively more difficult exams. So my great-grandfather passed one of those exams and was recruited as an official. And he proved himself and was, you know, steadily promoted until he became governor of Thái Bình province.
And he fought bandits, and he had to fight Mother Nature, and he was recognized for these accomplishments, but he didn't think too much, I guess, about that recognition. Would you tell us that story?
The Thái Bình province of which he was governor is irrigated by the Red River Delta, by the Red River. And this river, during the monsoon season, would overflow its banks and tear down the dikes that had been constructed to contain it. So at one point in his career, he had to fight the might of this river during the monsoon season. And he had to recruit workers to reinforce the dikes. He spent days and nights on the dikes supervising the work. And he saved the province from inundation, thanks to his efforts, and while the other provinces were inundated. So to recognize him, the emperor gave him a brocade robe, and the French government, which was then controlling the emperor, gave him a medal, a gold medal. But to show his ambivalence toward the French, he accepted the gold medal, but he hung it in his pigsty in his gesture of contempt. And, you know, that was the theme of the chapter on my great-grandfather, was the ambivalence of people like him toward the French, because they knew they couldn't fight the French. They didn't have the weapons to do so. But and they had to accept French domination, but they did so with great reluctance.
Yeah. Now, today, you write in that chapter that today, among the generations that follow yours, no one really cares about him or what he accomplished. To them, you write, his time is ancient history. That strikes me as being very sad.
Yeah, it is a very sad fact. And but the nice thing about my book coming out is that I'm getting a tremendous response from my relatives who recognize that this book is salvaging a legacy that would have been lost otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I'm very encouraged that my, you know, nephews and nieces, which represent the generation that I was referring to in that passage, that because of my book, they become very interested, and they devouring it, and so I'm very, very encouraged that they, once again, or at least the ones who have read the book, have become interested in this legacy.
Yeah. In the larger Vietnamese-American community, how is the book being received?
It's being received along the same line. At least the ones that I've talked to, you know, I've been on a book promotion tour, mm-hmm. and sometimes there are Vietnamese Americans in the audience, and the parents and the children come up to me and say how glad they are that I've written this book, which helped them to recapture the history of Vietnam. You know, it's there are a lot of books about Vietnam, as you mentioned, but very few tell the story through the eyes of the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
And this is the first book in English that does that. And the parents recognize that it's very helpful to their children, because their children no longer can go back to the original sources in Vietnamese and recapture this. So my book is a way for them to recapture their former country's history and tradition and culture that they otherwise wouldn't, you know, be interested in, or would take the time to learn about it. So the reaction has been very encouraging.
Hmm. What are your memories of being a girl in Nam Dinh?
I remember being pretty lost in a very large family. And, you know, my mother had 17 births,
mm-hmm.
and 12 survived, and I was 10th among the, I am the ninth among the 12 that survived. So my memory is of being lost in the family, but the most vivid memory of my days in Nam Dinh was actually of the Allied bombings of Nam Dinh during World War II. As I mentioned earlier, the Japanese had occupied Vietnam, and they were using Nam Dinh as a staging area for their troops and for operations in Southeast Asia. So the Allied were bombing Nam Dinh to strike at the Japanese, and there were many, many bombing runs on the city. So my earliest memory of childhood was feeling the vibration, you know, the house that we were living in shaking, and feeling the vibration of the glass windows. So I put my palm on the glass window and felt that vibration. And that is the earliest memory of childhood for me.
Hmm. What do you remember about the move to Saigon in 1954?
I remember how traumatic it was, because, you know, it happened so quickly. We had not prepared for it. And we knew that something might be happening, but we had no idea that the country would be partitioned and that we would have to pull up stakes and move. We could have stayed, but my father was afraid that, since he had sided with the French, the Viet Minh or the communists would persecute him and his family when they arrived as victors. So we pulled up stake and left for Saigon. I remember us trying to sell as many things as we could sell, so to raise cash for the move. I remember my parents' anxiety about moving south with you know, no accommodation waiting for us, no job waiting for my father. And it was just a tragedy.
Yeah. You know, we talked a moment ago about the ambivalence of your great-grandfather toward the French. It strikes me that your father was also very much in the same position.
Yes. My father, as with most Vietnamese at the time, wanted independence from the French. And but the only viable group, unfortunately, that could dislodge the French and end colonial domination were the Viet Minh, led by Ho Chi Minh. And he knew that the Viet Minh were led by the Communist Party, and he knew that besides defeating the French, their other agenda was to remake Vietnamese society along Marxist line. And he knew that he would be targeted, first of all, because he was working for the French, and second, because we came from a class background that the communists would not view with sympathy. So on the one hand, he wanted to end colonial domination, but on the other hand, he could not bring himself to join the Viet Minh, the group that was fighting the French. So his best hope was that the French would eventually give Vietnam independence, but he didn't know if and when that would happen. Mm. Yes.
History is unpredictable.
Yes.
After you finished high school, you obtained a scholarship to Georgetown, and you enrolled in the School of Foreign Service in 1960. What were your views about the U.S. and Vietnam at that point in the early 60s?
My view was that I was extremely grateful, like my family, and like, you know, most of the middle-class families in Vietnam. We were extremely grateful that the United States had come in and to help us fight the communists. So I was all for American involvement in Vietnam.
But that would change. Or your feelings about how the Americans were involved there would change, and whether or not the war would succeed. All that changed within a relatively short number of years.
That's right. My view of the communists and my fear of communism was at the bottom of why I was supporting the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. And I had been looking at them through the eyes of my family as evil people who should be eradicated, and that there was nothing good about them. But when I started working for the RAND Corporation, ironically enough, and I started interviewing Viet Cong prisoners of war and defectors, I began to gain a completely different view of them and their movement. And I saw that many people who were on the side of the Viet Cong had legitimate grievances against the Saigon government, and that they were driven by nationalism, and they wanted to end American intervention in Vietnam because they, you know, just to backtrack a little, Vietnamese history is driven by opposition to foreign intervention and domination. Our whole history is about resisting the Chinese and then later on the French. And so these farmers who were joining the Viet Cong were continuing in that tradition, wanting to end what they view as foreign meddling in their country. So they were driven by that desire, plus they were very upset by the division of Vietnam. They wanted to reunify the country again. So I thought that they had legitimate grievances, in other words, and goals that I couldn't quarrel with myself. And I found that they were not the evil people, not all of them anyway, that I had been led to believe, and that in their ranks were many people who were admirable, like my sister, older sister Tang and her husband, and they were selfless people. They were sacrificing their lives for a cause that they called it a just cause that they believed in strongly. And the second reason that I began to change my view was I saw how destructive the war had become to the Vietnamese people. And I saw that, in fact, we were sacrificing the peasants who live in the countryside, the crucible of the war, to save the middle class, like my family. And I thought it was unfair because it was the middle class that would suffer the most under the communists, not the peasants. Mm. So I think that was the key reason why I began to think that we should negotiate an end to the war, because I just thought the cost was too high for the peasants.
Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine is Mai Elliott. She is the author of The Sacred Willow, Four Generations in the Life of a Vietnamese Family. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. You mentioned working for the RAND Corporation. You went to work for RAND late in 1964, and your views by this time had already started to, I think the word you use in the book is soften. So you were now back in Saigon, and your assignment was to interview prisoners of war. RAND had a contract with the Department of Defense, and Robert McNamara wanted to know why the Viet Cong were more motivated and better fighters than the soldiers of the South. So this is now 1964. Talk with us about that first interview you went on.
As I mentioned earlier, I was looking at the communists through the eyes of my middle-class family as, people who were evil and who would bring disaster to Vietnam. So before I went into this first interview, I was kind of anxious, and of course I was very curious as to who to meet this first communist, face to face. So among the middle class, like my family, we view the communists and their followers as people who were not quite human. We call them people with the face of the horse and the head of a buffalo, meaning that they, subhumans. And so I walked into this room in this interrogation center and expecting to meet a brute. And the door opened, and in came this middle-aged man, very dignified, and, he sat down, and we started talking, and he was as surprised as I was by the encounter, because he had expected a tough interrogator. In Vietnam in those days, prisoners were not well-treated. They were usually beaten, sometimes tortured.
And I imagine it would have been quite unusual to have a woman do the questioning.
Yes, a woman and a young one at that, because I was only, 23, 24, and I was, not a tough interrogator that he had expected. So he was shocked, and so I was, and I was shocked too. And we started to talk, and I was not asking him for operational information or heart intelligence data that could betray his comrades. I was after information about him and his family background and what led him to join the Viet Minh and what led him to continue fighting for the Viet Cong, because this man was a seasoned revolutionary. He had joined the Viet Minh and had fought against the French. He was a warrior and a dedicated patriot. And see, the project that I was working with for RAND was really to measure the morale and motivation of the Viet Cong, to find out their background, mm-hmm. why they joined the Viet Cong, why they fought so bravely and stayed and kept fighting in spite of the, you know, the daunting odds that they were facing. So I was after more sociological, family, cultural, economic information rather than military information.
Yeah.
So my questions, he opened up because he could see that I was not after something that could harm his comrades. And also he felt that I was treating him as a person, as a human being, first time since he's captured. So he just opened up and talked, and I was very impressed by his eloquence. I was impressed by his dedication to his cause, and he was a true believer in what he called his just cause.
Yeah. You write that he was a man with more integrity than anyone you'd met in Saigon for a long time. Was Saigon, in your view, could you see a city that had fallen into corruption while you were there in the 60s?
Yes, very much so. It was corrupt, and it became more corrupt with the influx of American money, because there was so much aid money pouring in into a poor country. A lot of it was siphoned off by the military, leaders and politicians, political leaders, and the corruption reached a level that we had never seen before. It's just because there was just so many dollars sloshing in into the country the size of Texas. I remember the figure was something like in the billions,
mm-hmm.
and just imagine a small country with so much money floating around, it was just too tempting, and so corruption reached a scope that we had never known before.
Yeah. Now, your husband, an American, Dave Elliott, he did a military tour, and then he, too, was working for RAND on the same project. What were his views of the situation, and what kinds of conversations did the two of you have, and how were your thoughts about what was going on? How were they? I can imagine sort of being completely, as they say, flipped, turning completely over to the other side because you saw so much. What were his views?
Well, he went to Vietnam being very idealistic. He was the Kennedy era person, people of his generation believed in what John F. Kennedy declared at his inauguration in 1961. Mm-hmm. After he got elected in 1960.
Right.
It's bear any burden, defend the world for freedom and democracy, and it was a very idealistic time for the young people. So my husband was one of those people who went to Vietnam with idealism. He felt the United States was doing the right thing in Vietnam, defending a poor, weak people against communism. And his views began to change. He didn't change his views completely while he was in Vietnam. His views evolved in that he saw through his work that the United States was hurting the Vietnamese people, that it was coming in to help, in that the war was so destructive. It was killing and maiming a lot of people and destroying just, big swaths of the country. So he could see that American strategy and American tactics were not working. But he himself at that time just said that he didn't know what the solution would be. So even though he was changing his views and knowing that things were not working and that we were not doing the right thing that we had set out to do, he had no idea how we could extricate ourselves or end it in a way that would, you know, be would bring a happy outcome, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. What was the third force?
The third force was a group of Vietnamese consisting mostly, I shouldn't say that, a lot of the members belonged to the Buddhist church in Vietnam. They were Buddhists and pacifists and neutralists because they saw that South Vietnam was getting caught in this conflict of the Cold War between the Americans and the free world that wanted to keep communism from expanding. And on the other side, the communist bloc, you know, with the Chinese and the Russians trying to gain influence. And then they thought that Vietnam was the battlefield between these two blocs and that the war had really nothing to do with Vietnam. And so they wanted to end the war, and they wanted Vietnam to be neutral in this conflict of the Cold War. And they wanted the Americans to leave. They wanted to negotiate with Hanoi to end the war and bring about a peaceful solution to the conflict.
Mm. And you were hoping that they would succeed, but of course they had very little chance. They had no chance of succeeding.
That's right. They were very fractious. They were divided. You know, there was many different people of different backgrounds in there, and they were just not united or organized. And so they were also under pressure by the South Vietnamese government, which saw them as aiding the communist cause by opposing the war. So the South Vietnamese government was cracking down, too. So, and of course, they had no support from the Americans, who also view them as harming the war effort. So they were kind of caught in the middle. Mm-hmm. And without no backing and being so disunited and disorganized, they had no chance.
Yeah. You and your husband left after Tet in 1968. When did other members of your family begin leaving? Some stayed, some left.
They stayed until 1975, and their departure from Saigon was very dramatic. They left on April 29th, the day before communist tanks rolled into Saigon and took it over. And they left because I managed to get them out on an American flight. At that time, South Vietnam was falling to the communist offensive. And one province fell after another, because President Thieu of South Vietnam, the moment the communists started attacking, began to abandon territory. But his retreat turned into a rout, and the communists were racing toward Saigon to take it over. So my family panicked and called me in America and asked me to get them out. And I really didn't know what to do, because at that time, the American embassy in Washington was saying there would be no mass evacuation of Vietnamese from Saigon, because the panic was already setting in, mm-hmm. and the American government was afraid that any talk of evacuation would make the panic worse. So mm-hmm. they were saying mm-hmm. no evacuation. But there were American planes that were secretly moving Vietnamese out of the country. So my family, everybody heard about it, of course, in Saigon. So my family asked me to get them on one of those flights, and I didn't know what to do. So I filed a petition with the Immigration Service, thinking that nothing would come of it. But my petition was approved, unbeknownst to me, and a cable was sent to the American Embassy in Saigon. And then somebody at the embassy called my family and told them to gather at the villa in downtown Saigon. And they did, at least those that decided to flee gathered at this villa, and then they were bused to the airport, And they waited all night, and no helicopter came. And in the early morning hours, just hours before the communist tanks rolled into Saigon, American helicopters started coming in and picking up refugees who were waiting at the airport. And my family was flown to the USS Hancock that was docked offshore, waiting for the evacuation of refugees. And, you know, as they were picking up, mm-hmm. communist rockets were landing at the airport. So it was a very dramatic escape.
Yeah. We don't have time to tell the story of one of your relatives hanging from a helicopter, but...
Yes, that was my nephew.
Yeah. Maybe that will spur some folks to really get out there and get a copy of your book. But I did want to talk with you about one of your brothers. Very moving story about his. He remained behind and spent time in a prison camp.
Yeah, after the communists took over Saigon, they were very suspicious of people who had worked in the military or in the government of South Vietnam. The communists were afraid that these people would form an opposition against their regime. So they started incarcerating these people in what they call re-education camps. But in fact, they were prison camps. So my brother, who had stayed behind and were caught because Saigon fell so quickly, he didn't flee with the family in the helicopter evacuation, because he thought he had more time to get out later, but he was caught because the tanks rolled in right after my family had left. So he was caught in Saigon, and so he was one of the people who were incarcerated in one of these prison camps, and he spent about 4 years in the camp. He was not as maltreated as some of the prisoners who were sent to harsher camps, but it was, you know, prison, and he had to do manual labor, and you know, the anxiety of not knowing when he would be released, the anxiety of being separated from his wife and children who had managed to flee to the United States. And you know, he was an educated man who had studied for many years in France, and now being a manual laborer in a prison camp, feeding pigs and raising chickens. So it was a very difficult time for him.
Your family today is scattered around the world. Has there been a reunion? Are there plans for a reunion?
We have such a large family.
I know.
We talk about a reunion, but it's so hard to get everybody, you know, together in one place at one time. I was trying to have a reunion this summer in Paris, but things just did not work out. But there have been, you know, many reunions of us going to visit each other, some of us going back to Vietnam and meeting my older sister, Thang, whom... you know, we in the family had not seen since 1950. Mm. Like when I went back in 1993 to see her, I hadn't seen her for 43 years. And one of my brothers in France just went back last November and saw her again for the first time in decades. So there had been very emotional small reunions, but we haven't had a reunion where everybody comes, you know.
Yeah. That century-old vine.
Yes.
Big family. Your mother, has she returned to, has she been able to return to Vietnam?
No, she hasn't, unfortunately. She's now 96.
Yeah.
And she feels she cannot travel, and, you know, she cannot sit up for long. Her back bothers her, and she thinks a plane ride would be too much. So, you know, she longs to be back in Vietnam to see old places and to see my sister, because she hadn't seen my sister since 1950.
Yeah.
And it's this long separation has always been a hole in her life.
Oh, how hard.
Yeah, it's been very hard for her. But fortunately, with the telephone connection now, my sister can talk to her almost weekly. So she feels better about the situation.
I hope that your sister can get to France.
My sister is in very ill health, and she can't travel either. So there's no way we can bring the two of them together, unfortunately.
Sorry to hear that.
Yes.
Well, I do wish you and your family all the best, and thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Mai Elliott has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Look for her book, The Sacred Willow, Four Generations in the Life of a Vietnamese Family. It's published by Oxford University Press.